Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She's away on vacation all this week. This week, a Harvard professor was arrested when neighbors suspected someone was breaking into his home. The professor is African-American Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and he was entering his own home. Police quickly dropped charges of disorderly conduct and called the incident regrettable. But many people, including President Obama, say that racial profiling is widespread. Joining me in the studio to talk about racial profiling and President Obama's remarks is Dayo Olopade of TheRoot.com, and Henry Louis Gates Jr. Skip Gates is the editor of that website. From NPR's New York studio, Dennis Parker of the ACLU, and from KPBX in Spokane, Washington, Lori Friedel of the University of South Florida. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Nice to have you.
Good morning.
1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. We welcome your calls throughout this hour. Also, your emails, drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. We are here to answer your questions. And, Dayo, I mentioned Henry Louis Gates, Jr., one of, if not the most distinguished scholar of African-American issues, as a university professor at Harvard. Tell our listeners briefly what happened to him this week.
Well, I got the chance to catch up with Skip on Tuesday afternoon when he was in Martha's Vineyard, and he described the whole TikTok to me, which was that he had gotten back from a long trip in China. He had not forgotten his keys, as the president said last night, just to clarify. The door, the lock had been sort of busted. He walked around the back. He let himself in. They forced open the front door. And then a few minutes later, a police officer was standing on his stoop. And the conversation escalated. I'm not sure at which point the officer asked the Skip to produce his ID. He did, which had his address on it. And then things quickly went south. I think right then is when things should have been dramatically different if the police officer had been suspicious. But ultimately, the altercation, which took about 20 minutes from start to finish, ended up with Skip being taken to the Cambridge Police Department and handcuffed in prison for about 4 hours. And, you know, the nuance of these issues will come out, have been displayed in the police report and also in the account that Skip has given. And because the charges have been dropped, we might not be able to reconcile exactly what went on in there. But suffice it to say that both parties, you know, were very angry, it sounds like, throughout the whole thing.
Now, Professor Gates did say, this is how poor black men are treated every day in America. Mm-hmm. And also that this never would have happened if he were white. Do you agree with that?
I think that might be the case. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of evidence suggesting that race played a factor in the arrest. And again, I don't want to make
it seem... And the president himself tried to make that point that he didn't know.
That's right. I just, you know, I find it... it's difficult to avoid being so black and white, for lack of a better word, in this issue. It's not to say that, you know, this arresting officer was a complete racist or that Skip was in the complete right, but that race could have played a factor without this person being a monster, this police officer. And so maybe he would not have, you know, arrested a white person, but maybe he wouldn't have been called in if a white person were forcing their way into their house.
Let's play a clip from the president last night and his take on this, as Dayo was describing it. Please.
I don't know, not having been there and not seeing all the facts, what role race played in that, but I think it's fair to say, number one, any of us would be pretty angry. Number two, that the Cambridge police acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home. There is a long history in this country of African Americans and Latinos being stopped by law enforcement disproportionately. And that's just a fact. As you know, Lynn, when I was in the state legislature in Illinois, we worked on a racial profiling bill, because there was indisputable evidence that blacks and Hispanics were being stopped disproportionately. And that is a sign, an example of how, you know, race remains a factor in the society.
Now, the Lynn he was referring to is Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, who asked the question. Now, let me bring in Lori Friedel on this question. In addition to his comment about the police acting stupidly, what's your reaction to the president's argument and referring back to his own history in the legislature that racial profiling has been and remains a significant issue?
I absolutely think that racially biased policing exists, and we have a lot of work to do, and I'm dedicating much of my professional career to promoting fair and impartial policing. One of the things that the president said was that we have a lot of data showing that African Americans and other people of color are disproportionately intervened with by police. I appreciated the fact that he was careful in the wording, because that disproportionality doesn't necessarily tell us that bias is at the root of it. But indeed, we do have a lot of statistics showing disproportionate intervention with people of color.
Dennis Parker from the ACLU, what's your take on what the president said?
Well, I agree that there's a lot of data that shows that there are a larger number, a wide disparity in the interventions that affect African Americans, Latinos, and also particularly in the wake of 9/11, South Asian and Arab people. But I think that there's more evidence to show that this is, in fact, discriminatory, because that same data shows that not only are people of color more likely to have police interventions, but they're more likely to be arrested and are less likely to have contraband or whatever the reason for the stop is than whites. So the evidence shows repeatedly in study after study, and the ACLU has done studies across the country. Some states have done their own studies. Other organizations have done studies. But what they show consistently is that there still is a pattern of stopping people of color far more often. And the hit rate, the rate at which they find illegal objects, is actually less for people of color. So there really is no justification for it.
Dio, I'm looking at some Bureau of Justice statistics. Mm-hmm. For instance, among drivers at a traffic stop who were stopped by police, whites were searched 3.6% of the time, blacks almost three times mm-hmm. as often, Hispanics as almost as many as blacks. Number arrested, more than twice as many blacks arrested. So mm-hmm. these are federal statistics reinforcing what Dennis was saying.
Yeah, I think it's very true. And I think that the president was careful to frame the issue as one of culture as well as policy. I found it really interesting that he used the phrasing "any one of us," which is sort of a double entendre. It could be any one of any man who's in his home, or any individual who has been stopped by the police, or, you know, any black person, which was a very interesting and novel thing to hear from the president, to hear him speak about race. But I think he did correctly frame it as a matter of policy. And again, this is a matter of power relations and power dynamics, which is what this incident sort of underscores, which is when the police stop you, who has the right to do what? Mm-hmm. And I think in this instance, and the president is a lawyer, you know, Skip was in his own home, Professor Gates was in his own home, and had a certain amount of rights based on that. And the conflict escalated probably because of race, to be honest. But as Skip said in his interview with me, you know, the only person who's post-racial is living at 1600 Pennsylvania. There are a million black men in the criminal justice system, and he became one of them. And so now we're able to have a conversation around that, which I think should rightly focus on the policy implications and some of the work that the president did when he was in Illinois, as well as the work that your other guests have been looking at.
Lori, another thing that Professor Gates said in one of the interviews, he said of the policeman, he was stereotyping me. He has written in his own memoir that when I walk into a room, people see my blackness first before my Gatesness or my literary achievement. Talk about the nature of racial profiling and what how it actually works.
The social psychologists around the country from Stanford and Yale and University of Pennsylvania have done a considerable amount of work looking at racial bias in this country. And what is so interesting is that we've made a whole lot of progress, and we don't see it at the overt level, and people proclaim and hope that they are not prejudiced. We've certainly moved forward in that direction. But what they point out is that biases are still lurking beneath our consciousness. they refer to implicit or unconscious bias, mm-hmm. and how that can impact on how we see things and how we behave. And a key implicit bias that they have identified in American citizens is the link between people of color and crime. And most of the research has been on African Americans and crime.
But it's also true that that bias is not just held by whites. I mean, there's a famous comment by Jesse Jackson when he says, I hear footsteps behind me, and I hate to say it, but when I look around and see that it's a white behind me, not a black, I have a sense of relief. So this is pretty deep-seated.
They do find this implicit race-crime association across all types of demographic groups. There is one important intervening variable that might lead to lessened implicit bias, and that's the extent to which an individual has had positive long-term interactions with, for instance, people of color. So we do find it across all racial groups, but those people that have had those positive contacts are less likely to manifest strong implicit biases.
Now, Dennis Parker, one of the interesting figures in this case is the woman who called in, she was a neighbor. One wonders, I guess, why she didn't know that Henry Louis Gates lived there. But she, too, was part of this story of, on some level, unconscious bias. If you accept the argument that a lot of people make that she would not have made that phone call if the two people on the porch were white.
I think that's right, and I think that there are some things that I've read about it, and of course I wasn't there, so I don't know what happened factually, but from what I've read, she described them as being two big black men who were, you know, shouldering the door trying to get in. And if you know Professor Gates, he is not at all a threatening person. He's not big. He uses a cane. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of bias affected her perception of what was going on.
We'll be right back with you. I'm sorry, we'll be right back with your calls and your comments. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and our subject this hour, the incident in Cambridge, Massachusetts earlier this week when a very notable Harvard professor, Henry Louis Gates Jr., was arrested on the porch of his house, and the ensuing conversation about what this has meant for race in America. President Obama talked about it at his press conference last night. With me in the studio to discuss this issue is Dayo Olopade. She is with TheRoot.com. It's a website devoted largely to African-American issues, and Skip Gates, the professor involved, is the editor of The Root. From NPR's New York studio, Dennis Parker, the ACLU. From KPBX in Spokane, Washington, Lori Friedel of the University of South Florida. And let's listen to a little bit more of what the president had to say last night.
I am standing here as testimony to the progress that's been made. And yet, the fact of the matter is that, you know, this still haunts us. And even when there are honest misunderstandings, the fact that blacks and Hispanics are picked up more frequently and oftentimes for no cause cast suspicion even when there is good cause. And that's why I think the more that we're working with local law enforcement to improve policing techniques so that we're eliminating potential bias, the safer everybody's going to be.
We have on the phone with us, I believe, Mike Eads. He's chairman of the National Troopers Coalition, on the phone from Maine. Mike, you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. You heard our earlier discussion. You heard the clip from the president talking about the role of police. From the point of view of the Troopers Coalition, what is the significance of this incident?
I think it brings to light a lot of issues that we have been dealing with nationally. And, you know, it's a shame that this incident happened. I think, you know, I've had a chance to read the police report in the comments from the professor. And, you know, I be quite honest, I think there were mistakes made on both sides, both the police and the professor.
And what has been the history of police departments? There are some notable cases. New Jersey, Maryland have been under court orders. How has the professional law enforcement community been trying to deal with the issue of racial profiling, which, as the president himself said last night, the fact is that it exists. There's not really a dispute that this has been true in the past.
Well, I agree. You can't be a good cop and not be against racial profiling. You just can't be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the police, unfortunately, are stuck with circumstances. I mean, who's the highest percentage of murder victims in this country? African-American males, 17 to 34. You know, where these, quote, profile stops, you know, where are the guns, where are the drugs going? They're going right back into the African-American communities. So I think there's been a lot of good intentions. The intentions are to get the drugs, get the criminals, get the drugs off the street. And that takes, you've got to focus on certain groups of people. And
does that mean, are you saying, Trooper Eads, that a certain amount of racial profiling is necessary to protect the community from certain criminals who fit a certain profile?
I think there is. It gives base to racial bias policing, in that, you know, if you've got black males that are doing most of your drive-bys and your drug dealing and in African American communities, who should we concentrate on? You know, these drugs and the guns are going into the communities, and it's the African American civilians, the poor innocent citizens that are the victims here, and we're trying to protect them.
What about the African American men? I've been reading a lot of blog posts in the last day or two, and you have a whole series of men writing these pained posts where they say, you know, driving while black is still a crime, that it's a humiliating experience. So many of them who have never in any way been connected to any criminal activity find themselves stopped, searched, and humiliated by these by cops who, let's grant them that they're trying to do their jobs. But what's the other side of this? What's the danger of to innocent people of this approach?
I think the danger is you're violating these people's constitutional rights, and you can't make excuses for that. You know, stopping a person for no reason, we can try to justify it all we want, but there's no excuses for it. You've got to find a correct reason to stop somebody, a correct reason to search. And the case, you know, is built on that. It's built on law. It's not built upon hunches. And we should not have innocent victims being stopped for no reason.
And let me ask you one other thing, Trooper Eads, which I appreciate your being with us, and that's the question of training. Given this problem that the president talked about last night, that's been discussed in state legislatures and other places, how do you train police officers to deal with what might be unconscious bias, deal with, to try to find the right balance between, as you describe, protection, your legitimate mission of protecting communities, and not going over the line of violating individual rights?
Well, I deal with organizations all the way from California to Maine, north and south, and what we find, at least with the state police agencies, they are training in the academy. They're spending time in the academy, and they're talking about profiling, they're talking about, you know, people's rights. We have an obligation, and it's like I started out this conversation saying you can't be a good cop, and that's what we're told, and think that racial profiling is correct. You can't do it, and you've got to find that correct balance of honoring people's rights, yet at the same time going after the criminal, regardless of the color of their skin.
Mike Eads is chairman of the National Troopers Coalition. Thanks so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show this morning. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Lori Friedel, you specialize in the training of police officers. You spent a lot of your career on this. What's your reaction to what Mike Eads had to say?
Well, I don't know this systematically, but anecdotally, I know that if you ask agencies and academies, what are you doing in the terms of training in the arena of racially biased policing? They'll say all good things. We're reviewing the Fourth Amendment, we're doing cultural competency training, and we're talking about professional traffic stops. And those are all important. But I think the key to training is actually telling, for instance, recruits, having them reflect on their own biases and the potential negative impact of those biases on the things that they want, which is safe policing, effective policing, and just policing. And I'm working with some experts around the nation with funding from the U.S. Department of Justice to develop two curriculums. And the one for the recruits says this: we're going to tell the recruits, even well-meaning people have biases. These biases can impact on what you perceive and on what you do, and sometimes this occurs outside your own awareness. Policing based on biases is unsafe, ineffective, and unjust. And then we provide them with tools, not for getting rid of their biases, which took a lifetime to develop, but for ensuring that their behavior is bias-free. Mm-hmm.
Dennis Parker from the ACLU. One of the things that the ACLU has been focusing on is that while this incident highlights the issue of African Americans, this is not the only group that is subject to profiling in this country. The president himself mentioned Latinos last night, and the whole question of raiding workplaces heavily populated by Latinos to look for illegal immigrants, and the question of Muslims and Arab Americans who have been suspected of terrorist activity. So this issue goes beyond blacks.
It goes far beyond, and the effects that the trooper was talking about also go beyond just the question of whether or not constitutional rights are violated. And they really go to the relationship between various communities of color and the police. As a result of very wide sweeps of Latinos, which we've observed in states across the country, you have a community that is afraid to go to the police. And we've read instances where women who were being brutalized by men felt they couldn't call the police mm-hmm. because they would come in and take action against them or question their status in the country. We had a case of an Arab man who was forbidden to fly on a jet plane because he had a T-shirt that had Arabic writing on it and was not permitted to fly until he bought a T-shirt, ironically, an I Love New York T-shirt, to wear over it. And then was allowed on the plane. Now, clearly, there was no concern about safety, because if there was, they wouldn't let him on the plane. But the fact is, the combination of the Arabic writing and his ethnicity was what caused both the airline and the federal security agents to keep him off of that plane. And these indignities really add up and affect the way you feel about yourself and the way that you feel in relation to law enforcement and to the community as a whole. You know, I have no question that one of the things that Gates must have asked himself is, you know, what do I have to do to be able to enjoy being in my own house? You know, I'm one of the leading scholars in the country, and I'm not suggesting that there should be different standards depending on your level of education. But if not even he can be assured of this, what does that say for the rest of the people of color who haven't achieved his level of success?
Now, Dio, listening to Trooper Eads, he was trying to say that part of the role of the police is to protect the black community, which is often the victim of black-on-black crime, and that they wouldn't be doing their jobs if they didn't focus on people who might be suspects. What was your reaction to his attempt to draw a balance there? Was it fair or unfair in your view?
I thought it was a little unfair to sort of defend racial profiling in the guise of protecting the black victims of mm-hmm. what was presumed to be black-on-black crime, but wasn't stated explicitly. I also don't necessarily think that it's fair to focus on the traffic in drugs in black communities as if it's something that's reduced to and bounded by those communities. Certainly there are plenty of people of all races in America who enjoy recreational drugs and who contribute, therefore, to the blight of the communities that the trooper was referring to. And I'm not an expert on this issue, but This Is Your Country on Drugs by Ryan Grimm has a very good synthesis of this particular type of drug use in America and the effects that it has in terms of our criminal justice system. But what I think makes this a particularly pernicious issue is simply the fact that injustice makes people angry. And I think that just in a casual canvas of black men who I've spoken with in the last few days, it's something that incenses someone. It's something that makes their blood boil. It's something that has a particular effect on the psychology, as Lori was talking about. Explain why. It's because it strips an individual of any sort of other identity, any sort of other markers, your level of education, the places that you have been in life, whether you are Black American or from, you know, the Caribbean or from Africa or something like that. I think that there, you know, it removes all of the agency that you have. And your agency is already compromised when you're faced with a police confrontation, because a police officer is an authority figure. And again, you are supposed to supplicate to them. You are supposed to defer to them. You are supposed to do everything that they want, even as they have grievously insulted you. And so it is something that produces anger, which then causes these situations to escalate. And I think that's really what the problem that we saw, with Skip.
And that seemed to be very much the case.
And Skip is not an angry person. I mean, he's pretty calm, as Ron mentioned, is a slight 150 pounds, probably no more than that, and is a very calm person. And yet, this is the nerve. This is the nerve that you touch, and even a very rational person, and you could hear it in the president's statements yesterday, can just be inflamed into acting irrationally. And of course, in that case, a police officer is dealing with that terrain and not just the simple encounter.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I want to deal with one other question before we go to our callers, and that is the larger issue that the president brought up in his statements, where he said, "I am here as a symbol of success." And the president was very careful to balance his criticisms of racial profiling with saying, that a lot of progress has been made. And that's what he did in his speech at the NAACP recently, too, where he talked about the stain of racism, but also talked about progress. And I'd like each of you to react to that part of what the president had to say and how he's been trying to frame race as the first African-American president. Lori?
Well, first of all, absolutely, Americans are different, and police are a subset of Americans. They're not a deviant subgroup. So we've made a lot of progress in this nation in terms of races and our biases and so forth. And then policing is so much improved. You go back 30 years, the people that we're hiring now, they're educated, they want to be doing good policing in the community. We don't hire them to kick down doors. We hire them to communicate. So there's a lot of good things. So we're not starting at ground zero in this. And there are a lot of ways that police departments can promote fair and impartial policing.
Dennis Parker.
I agree that things have gotten considerably better. And I think part of that is evidenced by the fact that it's very rare to find someone who speaks out in favor of racial profiling. You know, President Bush made statements saying that it is not a good practice and it has to be eliminated. So there is progress to the extent that at least the problem is recognized, even if not nearly enough has been done to address it. I was particularly pleased to hear the president talk about what is going on now and how the effects of racism are still being felt. Many of his other comments, including ones about affirmative action, tended to focus more on the past and to suggest that the lingering effects or that the continued existence of discrimination, whether intentional or not, were really more of a thing of the past and not of the present. So I was glad to see his recognition, and I think that this incident hopefully will spark a discussion of the very many ways that there is inequality in the United States on the basis of race and ethnicity.
Now, Daya Olopade, also the president in his speech to the NAACP a few weeks ago, while talking about racism continuing to be a major issue in America, also tried to repeat a theme we've heard from him many times, which is the responsibility of black parents and the lessons that are taught at home, and that don't use racism as an excuse for not fulfilling your responsibilities as a parent. What do you think the significance of Obama's themes along those lines?
Well, I think that the message is sound. I think that paired with appropriate policy approaches to bolster the sort of cultural argumentation that the president has been making since before he was president to communities of color is the best sort of pairing to solve some of the problems that uniquely plague communities of color in the United States. But I do find it to be a little bit patronizing when folks say, you know, isn't this great? We have a black president that can talk to black people about their issues. And it's seen as a sort of dialogue within the community as opposed to a national question where black problems are American problems, which is, you know, fundamentally true. But also in an increasingly diverse and heterogeneous America, the problem of education is an American problem, as well as a problem mm-hmm. that affects black communities. The problem of the lack of access to health care, lack of access to nutritious food. All of these things are American problems. I think Obama has done heroic work in taking these things on across the board. It is always more resonant, of course, when he speaks to black people about these issues.
That's Dayo Olopade from TheRoot.com. Also with me, Dennis Parker, the ACLU, and Lori Friedel, University of South Florida. We'll be back with your call. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
More than 85,000 Americans are on the waiting list for a kidney. The true story of one man who travels to China for a transplant and an update on the eight-way multiple transplant in the U.S. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and our subject this hour, the issue of racial profiling raised by the arrest this week of Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. at Harvard and the comments by President Obama on the subject last night at his news conference. With me to talk about this subject is Dayo Olopade of TheRoot.com, from New York, Dennis Parker of the ACLU, and from Spokane, Washington, Lori Friedel, teaches at the University of South Florida. Let me read some emails and get some quick responses here. As both a I'm a retired police officer and a fan of Dr. Gates, writes this listener. I am sad that he chose to make his stand over this incident and calling it racial profiling. The police were investigating a call for a burglary in action. Initial reports were Dr. Gates refused to positively identify himself, instead insisting that a police take his word that he lived at the address. As a cop, writes this listener, I'd never walk away from a call like that without either ascertaining the identity of all involved. I'm pretty sure Mr. Gates, Professor Gates, given his prickly demeanor, writes this listener, on the radio in almost an interview, I'm pretty sure he was guilty of ticking off a police officer. In my younger days, anybody, male or female, white, brown, or black, who ran his mouth might have found himself in handcuffs. What do you think, Dennis Parker?
Well, I think that that it is true that, that a police officer has an obligation to assure that there isn't a crime going on. But my understanding of what happened is that he, in fact, did provide the information that was requested, showing that he was there legally, that the police officer refused on multiple occasions to give his own information, name and badge number. And although I understand the human frustration that police officers may feel, the fact is it is not against the law to get prickly with a police officer. It is not against the law to be loud or to be insulting. And, you know, should you do it? Of course not. Everyone should be civil all the time, but you should not use the power that you have as a police officer to take someone into custody because they annoyed you. And I think that's, you know, to a large extent what happened here.
And, Dio, this gets to the point you were just making before the break about the nerve that was touched in Professor Gates.
Right.
Steve, may I comment?
Just 1 second. Go ahead, Dio.
You know, I think that, yes, the power relations were very complicated in this instance, particularly because, you know, both of these individuals are used to being authority figures in one way or another. And so perhaps those tensions were inflamed even further. Just to throw a kink in things, and this is, you know, a point that a friend made to me. If this had been two women, maybe we would have seen something different. So maybe it was a gender thing. I'd love the counterfactual if a black police officer had showed up at the house. So who knows? But again, as was just pointed out very clearly, it is not against the law to yell at a police officer. And I further would just add that the language of the police report was saying that the Professor Gates was being rude and disorderly. I forget the words, but they're euphemisms for black people that are freaking out white people, you know, to be crude about it, where, you know, they're not, you know, they're behaving in a way that in the language of the law is sort of disorderly. But, you know, he was being righteously angry, I would imagine, in his own home, to the point where the officer felt like he could stick a disorderly conduct charge on him, which shows how heated the argument got. But I think for reasons we've outlined, that's pretty understandable.
Lori, I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
Yes, well, I have discussions with police around the country on a scenario that resembles this in some ways. I say that an 85-year-old white woman calls the police because there's a black male sitting in a car on the street, and I throw it out to the police. What do you do? And very often the default response is we go to the car door and we ask that black male to basically, you know, justify why he's there. And we need to expand this thinking. And this goes back to what Dio said. The police need to hear the voices of those very angry black males that are sick and tired of being asked to justify their existence on the streets of America. So we need to be thinking a little more broadly about how you deal with that. Maybe we call dispatch and get more information about the suspiciousness, but there needs to be increased empathy about the impact of the police approaching those black males.
And let me, Lori, read an email from Terry, who writes, I would just like to comment. It seems that the term racial profiling is being used as if it were interchangeable with the word racism. Should we be making a distinction?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I think one of the reasons this debate in this country hasn't been more constructive is there has been this cause and effect assumption that racism produces racially biased policing. I think even well-meaning people can produce racially biased policing. And if we recognize that, I think stakeholders and police can come together to move forward. Right now, because police are told it's racism that produces racially biased policing, it leads to incredible defensiveness, and it thwarts the change efforts that we need.
And Dennis Parker, let me read you this email from Tommy in Raleigh, North Carolina. Urban law enforcement agencies routinely stop white males who drive into certain neighborhoods with the justification that, quote, if a white guy is in this part of town, he's here to buy drugs or for a prostitute. Why does this profiling of whites not generate the same level of outrage?
Well, it should. I mean, it is the same problem. You are discriminating on the basis of race. There are all sorts of implicit expectations about who belongs where, and if they're someplace where they don't belong, in quotation marks, then they must be doing something illegal. That is also racial profiling, and I assure you that if you were to call our North Carolina affiliate with a report of that, they would take action. But it should be as outrageous. The idea is that someone is not being judged as an individual, but on the basis of their race.
Now let's turn to some of our callers. Paul in Cincinnati, you've been waiting. We appreciate your time, and thanks for joining us on the Dio Reem Show, Paul.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I was born and raised in a police family, and I worked my way through undergraduate school as a security guard and graduated from the Ohio Peace Officer Training because it raised my salary so much. And I was an officer in the military police corps in the Army. And based on what I have seen, personally being there, and hearing comments in places like the police chiefs association's meetings, my supposition would be, I would have to see evidence to the contrary. My supposition is that the policeman's action towards the professor was probably racially biased. Every time I am stopped by the police, for example, the time I had to break into my own car because I had locked my keys inside, I thank my lucky stars that I am white.
Thank you for your call, Paul. Dial.
Thanks for that. I think that, you know, your personal experience, you know, can only expand the data that we're working with here in this conversation. And I think that you're right to say that there is a history of this, and that your personal experience, you are maybe right to be thankful for being white in that situation. I guess I just don't quite understand why as soon as the professor presented his identification, the situation didn't change dramatically. And I'm still trying to sort of think through, because we don't know exactly what went on there. I just think that maybe class could have played an issue in this. Again, the sort of dueling ideas of authority could have played an issue in a factor in this. And I don't know to what extent we are so black and white about this. Again, you know, the president used the word "and yet." You know, I'm a testimony to racial progress in America, and yet we still have all of these issues. And I think that there is a gradient of the ways that race can be used in the justice system. But again, when you go back to it, and as you know, as a law enforcement official, you still identify suspects by their race, you know, and their height and their weight. Can we think of a better way to describe potential criminals or the innocent? When you say, you know, Henry Louis Gates, Barack Obama, and any black man on the street are all going to be a black man of a certain height and weight. And that is the real problem and gives a lie to the idea that we're beyond race.
Let's turn to Pierre in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Pierre.
Thank you. It comes down to supervision and guidance from the chief. You know, if you focus on the concept, you'll never get in trouble. But some of these police departments are out of control. And, you know, because of misconduct here in the city of Indianapolis, our public safety director, Scott Newman, resigned yesterday. And, you know, we've got police departments out here. For example, I filed a complaint against two IMPD officers here in Indianapolis. And here's the thing, friends, they never even responded to my complaint about police misconduct. And this is a city, our police department, we've got good officers, but we've got bad leadership, and we need a federal monitor here. And, you know, Attorney General Eric Holder, he's going to have to put a stop to some of this that's going on in around the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Pierre. Dennis, your reaction.
Yeah, I agree 100%, and I think that it is a question of oversight. It's a question of training. At a very basic level, it's a question of data collection. We very often see that there are no records kept, so you can't even really get a sense of who's being stopped, who's being arrested, what's being found, and you can't proceed unless you know what the problem is. So we have a platform of suggesting legislation that would ban racial profiling, that would require keeping records, that would require federal oversight, not only of what happens with the federal agencies, but what is happening in the state law agencies. And you know, we think that, you know, the things that the caller is suggesting are good, that there be an example set from the top, that this will not be tolerated, and telling you what you have to do.
Lori, we've been trying to define racial profiling in this broadcast, but some listeners still are having trouble with trying to find a clear definition and then decide whether this incident falls under that. Can you give us the best concise definition and whether you think this Gates incident is an example?
Okay. Well, let me start with a conceptual definition. A conceptual definition would be when race or ethnicity is used inappropriately by police in deciding with whom or how to intervene. That is very conceptual. And the key word in there is inappropriate.
Right.
And how people define inappropriate, first of all, it has to be in a department policy. And reasonable minds differ. One of the most restrictive policies says you only use race and ethnicity when it's in conjunction with a specific suspect description, which encompasses race or ethnicity. There are other policies that are a little broader than that. So there is no one definition of racially biased policing.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to Ramey in Washington, D.C. Thanks for waiting. You're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, how are you doing today? Great show. Let me just start off by saying I'm the son of a policeman. My dad was one of the first black policemen in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my best friends is a police captain in Birmingham, Alabama. But I was affected directly by a case some years ago in San Diego. Went up to the Supreme Court. Someone did bring a complaint where black male pedestrians were just routinely stopped, taken to the station, photographed, and fingerprinted. If you refused to be photographed and fingerprinted, you were told you'd be detained indefinitely. You were just detained. I had another case in Washington where I live now. I was walking to a club over by the Navy Yard past the military barracks. And I was on a city bus. The police surrounded the bus, asked me to get off, and I was told they had a complaint about a black male walking through the area. I mean, I was just shocked. But more immediately when I heard this, this thing could play itself out in the most bizarre ways. During the Jeffrey Dahmer case, many black residents had complained about Jeffrey Dahmer. Even the young Asian kid who he had kidnapped and was assaulting, people were saying that, you know, there's something wrong here. The kid was crying out. Jeffrey Dahmer, who was white, of course, said everything's fine here, and the police turned around and left without conducting any type of basic investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But the most bizarre case I can recall is an incident in Prince George's County outside of Washington where a black policeman was killed by two white officers who were responding to a report of a burglary. The home in question that was being burglarized belonged to the black policeman. The home indeed had been burglarized, but the policeman who was the owner arrived after the fact. The two white policemen arrived, saw him in the home, and said stop or something to that effect. Black policeman turned. He was shot down. He was killed. So, I mean, these things, I mean, they do happen, and the fact that it happened to the professor, because he's such a high-profile individual, brought it to light worldwide. But, I mean, if it happened to him, obviously it's happening to hundreds of others.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your call, Dio. This goes back to exactly what you were talking about earlier. You can hear in Ramey's voice a sense of that nerve you were describing that these incidents touch.
I mean, it's absolutely infuriating. And I think it's the kind of thing that, again, as Lori was talking about, it's unconscious bias. You know, you sort of revert to sort of human instinct in that situation where you would shoot a cop down in his own home just because you saw him turn and saw the color of his skin. And there's so many other instances of this, both old and new. There's the Amadou Diallo case. There's Oscar Grant, 2009, was shot down on the BART train, essentially in cold blood. And all of these instances, you know, are troubling and they're disturbing. But the question is how, again, from a macroscopic perspective, can you avoid the likelihood of these instances happening again? And there's where policy comes in. And the president did say that he had worked diligently on a particular bill working on racial profiling. And I think it was Ron earlier who brought up the point of Muslim Americans, Southeast Asians, increasingly being under the umbrella of racial profiling.
Right.
And so a really comprehensive strategy not to react or to protest these individual tragedies, but to do something big is necessary.
Let me ask quickly before we wrap up, each of you, to talk about what can and should be done now. As a caller pointed out, the Gates case has raised this issue and raised the whole question of public policy. Lori, what would you like to see the reaction and the result of this be?
Well, my work revolves around what I call a comprehensive program to address racially biased policing. And I work with police departments and I train command staff. And it has these areas within it: policy, education and training. One area, which is supervision, leadership, and accountability. We look at recruitment and hiring, institutional policies and practices, outreach, and then measurement. So there really are some best practices that are starting to be developed. I scan the horizons and I bring them all in and try to share them across the country.
Dennis, do you think there can be some benefit from this incident given its visibility and renewed focus on the issue?
I'm hopeful. There has been the End Racial Profiling Act pending since the late 90s, which has not moved, and I think having that passed would be a huge step. Making sure that include data collection would be important. We would suggest that the president issue an executive order prohibiting racial profiling by federal agencies. That we should comply with some of the human rights treaties that we've signed on to that also forbid racial profiling.
Have to be the last word. Dennis Parker from the ACLU. Lori Friedel, University of South Florida, and with me here in the studio, Dio Olopade of TheRoot.com. Also thanks to Mike Eads from the chairman of the National Troopers Coalition. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and thanks so much for spending your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.